from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum in our next hour, Bay Area-based author, former Twitter manager, and self-described media inventor Robin Sloan will join us to talk about his acclaimed debut novel, Mr. Penumbra's 24-Hour Bookstore. Forum is next. Join us for the hour after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. Robin Sloan joins us in studio for this Forum Hour, a San Francisco-based former Twitter manager, self-described media inventor, futurist, and short story writer who described the Internet as his native country in an interview on NPR. He recently published a novel called Mr. Penumbra's 24-Hour Bookstore, set mostly in San Francisco but also in New York. The novel follows an unemployed web designer named Clay Janin, who takes a graveyard shift job at what appears to be an all-night San Francisco bookstore, but turns out to have, in effect, a second store tied to a secret society of bibliophiles, a cult that goes back some 500 years and is, well, united in a search for the secret to immortality. Robin Sloan joins us for this hour of Forum. Good to have you here. Welcome.
It's great to be here. Thank you so much.
Well, where do we begin? I think as a kid you must have done a lot of Dungeons and Dragons and read a lot of dragon books and everything. But what I like about this book, among many other things, is the way you combine a bibliophile nature, and it's all about bibliophilia, really, with I guess what we could call uber geekdom or something like that.
Yeah, that's right. You know, a love for books and a love for technology. I don't think that's actually that rare. I think there's a lot of people out there who, you know, as a kid and certainly even as an adult, they find themselves drawn to the library and to bookstores. But they're also all over the Internet, and they're excited about phones and video games and all that kind of stuff.
So it's interesting. I was at a friend's house last night, and one of the people there was talking about going downtown now every day and seeing everybody looking at their iPhones and looking. I mean, and that, he said, but I don't see them reading books. And I thought to myself, maybe he's onto something. Are we? You don't see it that way, though.
I don't. I tell you, my go-to market research is to kind of walk up and down the cars on BART, the BART train, or even Muni in San Francisco proper, and you just look at what people are using. And I actually think it's very encouraging because there are a lot of phones and a lot of people lost in their—
A lot of Kindles, too.
Yep, and a lot of Kindles, but there's a lot of paper books. And even in the paper books, there's a great diversity. You know, it's everything from big, heavy hardbacks, those giant like fantasy tomes, to library books. You know, you see the kind of telltale lamination and the kind of Dewey Decimal Code of the library book. So it's everything. You know, I think that's good. I think it's good to live in a world where people have all these choices, all these different ways to read.
Well, there are different ways of reading your novel, too, I think, which kind of interests me, not only in this dichotomy we're talking about, which may not be a dichotomy for many, as it is not for you, between technology and books. But this is a book which is really, in some ways, sheer fantasy, a fabulist book, we would call it. A fabulist with a T on the end. Maybe fabulous as well. but also a realistic book. I mean, you know, you go to some pains, for example, to really give us a lot of detail, like the coat buttons, as Mr. Penumbra pays attention to. I don't want to get too esoteric about the novel here. But there's a lot of attention to detail, a lot of attention to realistic detail.
Yeah, that's right. You know, I think I look at a writer like William Gibson and these other writers, you know, it's nominally science fiction, maybe, but it's really about the science fictions that are lurking in the corners of our real everyday world. You know, the notion that if you just knew what corner to turn on and what door to open, you know, somewhere here in the Potrero Hill neighborhood, you would find someone working on a artificial intelligence or a robot or a drone or something. The notion that there are little bits of science fiction embedded in the reality of our day-to-day world.
And also the idea just about, well, subterranean esoteric worlds that are out there. I mean, one thinks of San Francisco as maybe being redolent of all that.
I think that's right. No, actually, it's true. It's the question is a little less mysterious here in San Francisco, because you could probably choose a door at random and find something interesting lurking behind it, some secret society.
Well, in fact, what comes immediately to mind is the surprise and delight that you had opening one of those bookshelves or pushing it back in New York and finding a secret compartment.
Oh, absolutely. As part of the kind of launch of Mr. Penumbra's 24-hour bookstore, I got to go to a place called the Grolier Club, which I hadn't heard of before. It's a society of real bibliophiles and real book scholars in New York. And man, it is everything you want that sort of a place to be. It's all dark wood and ancient tomes, and sure enough, a real secret passage in the shelves.
You've also got to a sense of some of these characters, I mean, that would be in this kind of world. Looking at the work of a 15th century printer, particularly named Aldus Manutius?
Manutius, yeah. Yep.
Now, where did you discover this guy? Gave us the comma and the semicolon, among other things, invented a whole italic type of print?
That's right. I mean, so this is an amazing guy, and I wish he was better known. He's well known to bibliophiles and to graphic designers as well. He's essentially the first great printer, and when you read about his life and the world he lived in, the really astonishing thing to me is not that it was, you know, classical and sort of austere and august, but rather that it was crazy. I mean, he was in competition with all the other printing houses in Venice to see who could come up with better books and things like italic type. You know, that was essentially the search engine of its day. It was a huge innovation, and it was based on that innovation that he made a big business. Of course, now we take it totally for granted. You know, it's Command I on every computer ever. But at one point, that was a big deal.
So how did this whole idea morph? I mean, I know a little bit about your background. You got involved with Joel Hyatt, for example, mm-hmm. New Ideas and Digital Strategy. I'm not going to necessarily ask you to comment on Al Jazeera and the sale, but
yeah.
Current, which is a co-owned by Hyatt and Al Gore. But you had a phone app called Fish.
And, yep.
And also, this was a story before it was a novel.
This was a short story. And actually, even before it was a short story, it was a tweet, and not even my tweet. It was a friend of mine. And I just love that things can start this way, you know, these days in the 21st century. It started as a tweet. I remember it so well. I was walking down the street right here in San Francisco, and my friend Rachel tweeted, "Just saw a sign that said 24-hour book drop, but misread it as 24-hour book shop. My disappointment is beyond words." And I remember it made me smile, and I jotted it down because I thought that was kind of interesting. Like, what would a 24-hour bookshop be like? And, you know, fast forward, that kind of grew into a whole scenario and a whole story, and here we are.
And the name Penumbra?
You know, Penumbra, so many things I can trace back to scraps of language I found on the internet or copied down from articles or heard on the radio. That one, I don't know. It just came one night and it seemed right.
Well, we have this guy, Clay Janin, who goes into this bookstore, takes a job with Mr. Penumbra. All kinds of strange and mysterious things happen. You get involved in a suspenseful plot, which is fairly well rendered, I might add. And there's also, I thought the book was well rendered. I'll tell you one concern I had, though, and it ties in with the whole sense of the new technology. That is, we've got two romances. We've got two of his roommates involved in a romance, and we got him with a wizard from Google, mm-hmm. a young woman who named Kat, who actually is brilliant. But I'm thinking, where are we going with the romances? And that kind of gets trailed off with the mystery story. Now, I'm not necessarily registering this as a complaint, just as a serious reader, and I know you appreciate serious readers, because recently a woman friend of mine was at an event. It was supposed to be a singles meeting event with mm-hmm. all these Silicon Valley types. And she said, "That's a very attractive young woman." She said, "Michael, we could have been wearing lingerie or underwear, and these guys were with their apps. They wouldn't have noticed us." I mean, there is that world there.
And absolutely.
You're in that world.
Absolutely. You know, I think it's actually so interesting. Imagine a world where, you know, a person's job, we think of that just classically as, you know, it's the chore, it's the 9-to-5, it's the thing you have to do to, you know, kind of make the rest of your life work. But we live in a world and in a place where people's jobs are so exciting to them, so compelling. They feel like they're working on such engaging things. And I think such important things, you know, things that have potentially...
Takes away their libido?
I mean, could it be possible? It's more exciting than dating. It's more alluring than our human relationship. And I think that's, I mean, the truth is some of these problems, some of these projects, they are really big. They are really important. I think it's actually really interesting and potentially a really productive tension.
As important as singularity? I mean, we just had Ray Kurzweil on a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
I mean, they get caught up in those kind of ideas, but then you find people working in Silicon Valley thinking in fairly small silos, thinking that they're going to make a world of difference too.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, of course, the path with all these things is balance, and you know, as with print books and ebooks, the truth is you can have all these things. You got to just mix them together in a bag, carry them all in your backpack. But it was fun. I was happy to make. I will say this, you know, your friend kind of mentioned the techno obsessed dudes of Silicon Valley. I was happy and proud to make my brilliant programming whiz a woman.
Well, she is a whiz. Do you really think that there's sushi without mercury anywhere?
No, probably not. I don't think that's available.
You have these places that are definitely recognizably San Francisco, like that Gourmet Grotto. And
yeah.
Let me ask you, actually, you know, there's a description early on about San Francisco. I'm going to ask you if you would just read it.
Sure, of course.
Because, again, I'm thinking about what you do in terms of drawing a picture for us, drawing a visual for us and the details.
Which part?
Just on page 6 there.
Ah, of course. San Francisco is a good place for walks if your legs are strong. The city is a tiny square punctuated by steep hills and bounded on three sides by water. And as a result, there are surprise vistas everywhere. You'll be walking along, minding your own business with a fistful of printouts, and suddenly the ground will fall away, and you'll see straight down to the bay with the buildings lit up orange and pink along the way. San Francisco's architectural style didn't really make inroads anywhere else in the country, and even when you live here and you're used to it, it lends the vistas a strangeness. All the tall, narrow houses, the windows like eyes and teeth, the wedding cake filigree. And looming behind it all, if you're facing the right direction, you'll see the rusty ghost of the Golden Gate Bridge.
Yeah, that's really quite good. And by contrast, when Kat, our female wizard, goes to New York City, she sees it as a skinny place. And she just gets out of the Bay Area for the first time and suddenly looks at New York as a sandwich too, right?
That was one of my favorite moments, you know, because she comes across as so smart and really so wizardly with such amazing capabilities, but then to, you know, take her out of her native land and make you realize that she's actually just 20-something who hasn't seen that much of the world, and she's sort of astonished, and it doesn't match up to her, you know, imagination or what she's seen on Google Street View.
Like an ingenue in many ways, or a naive young woman because of her age. In fact, there's a scene here where he can't join her because of his nighttime shift at the bookstore, so he joins her virtually.
Mm-hmm.
Is this done, by the way, this sort of thing?
You know,
where you go to a party and you just put down a laptop?
Yeah. I've not seen it myself. I have heard stories. I've absolutely heard stories of sort of virtual party attendance where someone would kind of get set up in the corner as a little floating head in a screen, and people would wander up with their red party cups and, you know, strike up a conversation. I do think the video chat broadly, man, talk about those things that kind of seemed like science fiction for a long time and then suddenly got really real. Video chat is a part of a lot of people's lives now, and I actually wanted to make sure to put it into the book for that reason.
Well, and Skype one thinks of too.
Yeah.
I misspoke, though. I said she sees New York as skinny and a sandwich. I meant to say and a sidewalk.
That's right.
The sense, though, of these two working together along with, an old boyhood friend, and I mean, comes together really like a crew, a team, searching for answers that people have been searching for centuries. And suddenly the technology moves everything forward at such a rapid pace as it has for all of us. I mean, it becomes a really central metaphor for our lives.
Mm-hmm. That's right. I mean, one of the things that Kat says, and she means it, and I guess I sort of mean it too. This is one where it's kind of me talking through a character. She says, you know, one of the things about working at Google is you realize that things that used to be hard just aren't hard anymore. You kind of have to shift your sights. You have to, you know, change the way you look at the world and evaluate the things around you, because suddenly we've got these tools that, you know, even 5 years ago, certainly 10 years ago, we wouldn't even have dreamed of.
Well, how much do you talk through your characters, by the way?
I'll be honest. I would say a fair amount. I have some opinions about the world that we live in, and I try to kind of sneak those in there. I think that is one of the great pleasures, actually, of writing fiction, that you can kind of slip some of your own ideas in there and have them show up.
Well, you certainly have a lot of ideas about Google. Have you spent a lot of time on that campus?
I have spent a small amount of time on the campus. I've been down there, and I definitely know a few Googlers. I would say that the rendition of Google in Mr. Penumbra's 24-hour bookstore is an affectionate exaggeration, you know.
Do they have that PM type of management that you...
I think that's actually something that's it's funny, I think, when you work at it.
Explain what that is.
Yeah, of course. In the Google of the book, it's run by the elusive product management, which is this sort of uber democratic crew of managers that get together for these marathon meetings where people are constantly sort of chatting with each other in back channels and voting live on things like acquisitions and new strategy. I do not think that Google is actually run by a egalitarian group of citizen managers. But I have, as an employee of companies like this, found this concept of product management to be totally fascinating. And so that's another thing that I wanted to just make sure I slid in there and sort of had some fun with.
Sliding all over things. Robin Sloan is with us in studio. His new book, a novel, is Mr. Penumbra's 24-hour bookstore. What about body hacking? Can you explain that to us?
Yeah, that's another sort of moment at Google is when one of these super fit engineers, they totally betray all geek stereotypes because they're in such great shape. Mentions that he's into body hacking. He's trying out different levels of potassium to see like what they do to his brain. And that's, I mean, in some ways, the version of that that shows up briefly in Penumbra is a total, it's not even as wild as some of the things that people are really doing as part of this so-called quantified self movement. This notion that if you kind of track what you're doing, how many steps you take, how many grams of this and that you consume, you can discover patterns about yourself and your body and your life that would otherwise have been invisible. It's such a Silicon Valley thing.
Well, it's also, I said we had Ray Kurzweil on, and they are looking for, you know, secrets of eternal life and all that sort of thing. But I don't know if there are books like the Wayback books in the bookstore that Google doesn't know about. I mean, it seems like Google has a corner on really all the books that are out there.
Well, that's one of the nice things about books. They have a lot. I will give them that. But there's, of course, all the books that are kind of in circulation, you know, books that have ISBNs and books that you could search for on the internet and, you know, see some records for. You'd find them on Amazon or, you know, Powell's or whatever else. But there's a lot more books beyond that. There's books that aren't being printed anymore, books that had their last printing 80 years ago, 100 years ago. And I will say one of the really wonderful features of the printed book as a format is it's durable. It sticks around. And I think there's a fair number of those kind of books out there in storage units and boxes that Google doesn't know anything about yet.
Actually, the whole question looms over this book about the future of books and just how secure that future is. I remember interviewing a great semioticist, Umberto Eco, who's also a novelist, and he said, yeah, they thought, you know, as soon as photography came on the scene, there'd be no more photographs, there'd be no more paintings, you know, they would be replaced and so forth. But as you point out in the book, people just love the feel of books and the smell of books, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm, just the textual page in front of them. Mm-hmm. And yet everything's changing so radically, as you say. I mean, you know, looking at text messages now and looking at emails, and it's become a whole different kind of visual. Maybe our neurons are changing too.
Well, I would say they almost certainly are changing. But I think one of the things that you get reading about all this minutiae in the early history of books is an appreciation of the fact that it's always been changing. There was never a time when it was settled. There was never a time, I don't think, when our neurons weren't challenged, you know, weren't changing in response to new things. The very beginning of books history was a story of, you know, tumult and turmoil and nobody knew how to do anything and everybody was arguing over, you know, how to mix the ink and how to print the books and how to distribute them and how they should look. And it turns out those arguments never stopped.
Have you read Stephen Greenblatt's book, The Swerve?
I haven't, no.
Because it's a whole theory about how everything changed, really, after one particular poem was published because of the way it was disseminated. But now, of course, you've got this world of the internet where things are disseminated immediately to, you know, just countless number of people. But to try to think about that, say 25, 30 years ago, to try to have conceived of that, as you've suggested, and I know you're a futurist and you think in futurist terms, but you posed a question in the book, how can we imagine what's in the 31st century?
Yeah. I'm so engaged by that question. This is probably one of the best places in the world in terms of being surrounded by people who are actually quite good at that, or at least as good at imagining the future as you can be. And it turns out that even the very best of us are awful at it. I mean, it's really, really hard.
It's almost like getting your mind around, say, millions of people. You can't just
We're not built for it somehow. Yeah, all we can do is we can kind of extrapolate in short, straight lines. And that's the best we do. So we imagine flying cars and, you know, jetpacks.
Or in your case, you imagine codes that may exist that we still haven't broken. Mm-hmm. It's interesting that there's, I don't want to give away a lot of the plot here, but a lot of the book has to do with the inventiveness of Clay and the other people that he's associated with, but also stealing.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah, there's plenty. There is book copying. There is piracy of expensive typefaces. There's shadowy underground networks. The people who first cracked the DRM on the Harry Potter books and, you know, distributed them to the world.
Yeah, I learned a lot. I mean, I didn't know what Hadoop was. I didn't know about the Mechanical Turks. If you're a geek, in fact, this is just a storehouse of knowledge and a feast in many respects. But it's also a book that, you got this guy Penumbra. And he's kind of an old world charming guy, you know, and you're drawn to him because everything is very kind and gentle in his way and everything. And yet he's surrounded by all this mystery. And he's got a guy, I don't want to give away the plot, a guy named Covina who's sort of over him in the hierarchy. Was I wrong in thinking of Scalia?
You know, it's funny you say that. They're all in black robes, all the members of this strange cult. And, you know, I don't know if I even realized that before this moment, but I think I was. I was thinking of you know, judges. And they have a bit of that character, too. You know,
and Corvina, like Scalia, is pretty
by the book,
inflexible.
Strict constructionist. Yeah. I think you're onto something there.
Well, good. I like to be onto something. I mean, when people can read your book and find things that you didn't necessarily intend, that's always a good sign.
Yeah, I agree.
This book could be a film, too. Have you talked to anybody? Anybody talked to you?
You know, I think it would be interesting. I, of course, would love for it to be made into a movie, in part because I have no idea how you do it. I'm not exactly sure, actually, what parts you'd keep.
They could do the Da Vinci Code. They can do your
A lot of it happens on screens, and as we know, that's hard. That's where you get into weird territory, and it's suddenly all kind of fake.
So they could do The Life of Pi. Trust me, they could
Fair
do
enough. I'll take your word for it.
We're talking to Robin Sloan. If you've just joined us, his new book is Mr. Penumbra's, his first novel, debut novel. Always a tough thing to do, 24-hour bookstore. He is a local, and he's here with us in studio, and you can talk with him. Put out some questions to listeners, by the way. Books and technology, are they separate? Can they be fused? Are they two cultures? Those are big questions in my mind, always have been. Sort of a sillier question in some respects, but how much is libido depressed in the world of Silicon Valley or just as romance in general?
I like
Let's
that
not
one.
Not necessarily talk about sexuality. And do you ever think about what's up ahead and what do you think about? And the 31st century is really maybe out of bounds for most of us, but, you know, it's maybe even taxing and difficult and formidable in every way to think of what's up ahead quarter of a century or even a decade from now. Join us in conversation here with Robin Sloan. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786. We welcome your calls. It's toll-free, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website and post any questions or comments you have there, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And we're invested in this new technology as well. You can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. And you can also, of course, join us on Facebook. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending this hour with Robin Sloan, author of a new book, his first novel, Mr. Penumbra's 24-Hour Bookstore. And he's a former manager at Twitter, also a self-described media inventor. I've got to ask you about Twitter, by the way, since it came up in the last hour. We were talking about the housing market, and somebody sent an email in, and Carolyn Saeed, who writes for the Chronicle Real Estate, so forth, was a little reluctant. But the question was about Mayor Lee giving the tax break to Twitter, and you know, clearly the person who sent us that email, or actually posted on our website, was quite displeased with it, as mm-hmm. lots of people have been. Mm-hmm. Any thoughts about that?
Well, you know, as a fan of the city, way more so than sort of the peninsula. I should say I've never been somebody who lived their life down on the peninsula in Google country, you know, in Mountain View and Cupertino and all that. I'm just so happy to see the center of gravity. It might not be shifting, but it's sort of becoming like a binary star system. That wasn't always the case. You know, even 5 years ago, that wasn't the case. There just weren't these big tech companies deciding to plop down in San Francisco. So I think if we can kind of cement that position, that balance of power, I think that's a good thing because I like the city.
Well, you listeners may want to weigh in on that as well, but I threw out some other topics and I'll just reiterate, interested in hearing your thoughts about the divide, the binary world, if you will, as many see it between books and technology, and is technology subsuming books? Are we quickly seeing perhaps books falling into oblivion as we now have all the e-books and traditional books, let's put it that way, as we now have people with Kindles and all that. And I also asked the question, a little bit of an off the wall question, about how does all that Silicon Valley, and I'm talking directly maybe to some of you who work in the world of technology, how does it affect your life vis-a-vis romance, or for that matter, your libidinous drives? Those are questions that are of interest. And you can join us, by the way, at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. And if anybody has any predictions, forget about the 31st century, but if you have any predictions, say, even in the next quarter of a century, about where you think things are going to, and use your wildest imagination here, you know, like 2001 or something along those lines, email us, forum@kqed.org, or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Or you can join us by going to our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on this segment or go to our Facebook page. Let's bring our callers in here. And by the way, I want to bring a caller in, right? Chris, that's you. Hi.
Hi.
Yes, sir. You're on the air with us. Welcome.
Hey, I just wanted to comment on product management in Silicon Valley for startups and how it really is such a strong, exciting drive with so many product managers working in network with so many other startups. That excitement really does kind of overwhelm you. It can take up your time. You can start working nearly 20-hour days immediately. And like you had commented, it can overshadow almost everything else in your life. And that, how you were talking about women not, you know, men not being interested in women, you see that a lot down here. And it's pretty shocking. It really is how powerful this network effect is down here among startups.
Well, he used to call it sublimation. I don't know what you call it, Robin, but it he's talking about a real thing. People say they have no life.
Absolutely. And I mean, it's again, I think what's interesting is that it's not this sort of subservience to some corporate ladder and you're like, well, you know, I can focus on my life after I make partner. It's not that old model. It's something very different. I think, as Chris says, it's this real, like, I don't know if it's a missionary zeal. I think it's authentic. I think it's this real excitement and this knowledge that if you put in the time and you get your crew together, you can make something great. The challenging thing is that's not imaginary. That's real, and it's very alluring.
And I thank you for the call, Chris. Well, when your protagonist, Clay, starts out, he was working for a place called New Bagel, which is
that's right.
Interesting startup. And then it turns out that after a while, he finds himself unemployed, and he's hit by the recession. He's awfully clever. You know, they used to, as a British, we put a clever by half and so forth. You think there are a lot of people just out of work who have these kind of technological and really gifted minds?
Not if they have technological skills. Not if they're great engineers or great designers. I think that's actually one place where that dip probably hasn't dipped too deeply, and it's back now. If you're a designer, even a you know, neophyte designer with one web page under your belt like Clay, I think you can get a job in about 14 hours in San Francisco today.
And do you know women like Kat who get excited by new programming and all
that? Yeah,
I mean, really?
Absolutely, absolutely. And especially that nexus. You know, Kat in the book is a designer and an engineer. She's someone who loves data visualization. She loves being able to kind of sling around huge piles of data and kind of paint pictures with them. And that's a very real character and a very real kind of person that I, frankly, am fascinated by and a little intimidated by as well.
Well, you're also fascinated a bit with the roommate character, Matt. He also gets into the, that is, you also get into the DIY inventor world of San Francisco. You've been part of that, too?
You know, I've been part more as an observer than a participant, but I will say I've spent a few hours using the laser cutter at Tech Shop up in San Francisco. And so the laser cutter scene in the book is, that's based on real experience. I've cut a few things out with a laser.
You know, somebody who read this book told Dan Zoll, our senior editor, that she cried. Did you get that kind of emotional response from any reader?
You know, especially—
when she got through the end, the epilogue.
Especially the end. Yeah, I think there's something about the way it all ties up. I will let me put it this way. It's actually been polarizing. A lot of people hate the epilogue. They think it's, you know, just like, give me a break. What a cop-out to kind of go through and cover the bases.
I think Rebecca Gay in the New York Times was not happy with the epilogue.
No, that's right. That's right. And that was actually pretty characteristic for some of the critical response. But then on the other hand, I've seen tweets. I've seen reviews on Amazon. And I've gotten emails myself from people saying simply, you know, thank you. I closed the book and there was a tear in my eye, which is pretty awesome.
Do you know you were going to write the epilogue?
No, not before I sat down and wrote it. Yeah. Absolutely not.
Let's hear from Josh, who joins us next. Josh, welcome to Forum.
Good morning. It's a really interesting discussion. I'm an older guy. I'm almost 50, and I work with a lot of young people up and down the peninsula in different industries, including some of the designers and engineers that you're discussing. And I got to tell you, I've watched a cycle occur several times where these young people commit themselves in tremendously energetic ways to projects because they see the opportunity for fortune and glory on the horizon. But as you well know, more often than not, neither of those two things materialize. And what I've found myself having conversations with people who have come to realize that they gave everything that they had to an idea or a pursuit that left them without financial rewards, professional rewards, or emotional rewards. It's like a career lottery that they're playing, and many of them, after the game is over, realize they didn't understand what they were doing, and they're really disappointed with the outcome.
You know, it's interesting to hear you say that you've had these chats with folks, and it makes me think, or I guess it makes me wonder, should we have more of, do we need more of that kind of cross-generation mentoring? I think the answer's got to be yes. You know, I think of some of the places I've worked and places I know of where it's like, I mean, not exactly the blind leading the blind, but it's pretty close. And the truth is, you know, it's true. We've been here before and people have had these experiences before. Maybe we need a little bit more of that knowledge transfer, some of that wisdom transfer.
Well, we thank you for the call, Josh. I wondered about booties. Sorry about that, but, you know, there is this apparent place that involves, I don't know, I guess striptease or something like that, but we never find out what's there in the book. It remains the mysterious store.
That's right. That's it's sort of fictional. I think it's actually very appropriate that you never quite know what's inside, because that's the way I feel about some of these seedy places, you know, kind of down on Broadway and North Beach. For all the years I've lived in San Francisco, I've always thought, what is that place? What, I don't even understand what that is for. And that's what booties is. It's you're not supposed to know. It's just supposed to make you feel kind of weird.
I may be wrong about this. I think the author Naomi Wolf, who grew up in San Francisco, calls that area of North Beach Sexville or something like that.
Fair enough.
Close enough.
But of course, also home to City Lights, the great sort of center of San Francisco literary culture.
Another place where people still go who are bibliophiles.
Yeah.
Here's Gavin, who tweets, "The hostility of geek culture to women is a big issue. By the way, we talked about it here on Forum. Could Robin Sloan talk a bit more about why he made his super geek a woman?"
Absolutely. I mean, that's because, like a lot of the characters in the book, I knew of people, certain kinds of people, certain archetypes that I just didn't feel were well represented in fiction today. And one of them was the really smart, really charismatic female engineer. There's a lot of them. I've worked with plenty.
Melissa Mayer.
Absolutely. I mean, this is a really important figure in Silicon Valley, in sort of the startup world, especially right now. And there's a few in literature. There's a San Francisco writer, Ellen Ullman, who wrote a programmer's memoir 15 years ago called Close to the Machine. She is this smart, charismatic, and actually very articulate programmer. But man, one every 15 years, that's not enough. So I wanted to get that down on the page.
We also having fun with Clay's friend, Neil, I mean, who really made his fortune out of, breasts, women's breasts, really.
That's right. Software simulations thereof. Yeah, I think that's another thing where, you know, there's these, we know about the Googles, and we know about the Facebooks and the Twitters, but there's actually all this interesting technology, sort of the tools, the cogs in larger machines. You know, you might start a company that makes the software that makes water. It renders water in, you know, video games and in, you know, 3D animated movies.
Too,
yeah. And I think that stuff's really interesting, the sort of people who are stocking the toolbox for other people who are making games or movies.
And again, we're talking to Robin Sloan, author of Mr. Penumbra's 24-Hour Bookstore, and our next caller is Vincent. Good morning.
Good morning. Hi, I'm Vincent in Sunnyvale, and I'm really enjoying this discussion. I actually stopped driving to go to a bookstore and try to get this book, but apparently it's so popular that it's sold out. So just wanted to pass that along. I have a question. I am currently an aspiring writer who is attempting to write a Silicon Valley novel as well, although mine takes a more satirical view on the Valley culture. I was wondering if you were able to find any Silicon Valley fiction books out there to draw inspiration from, because I found that there was a bit of a dearth of it as I was beginning researching this novel.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think there is a dearth. I've heard from folks that I ought to have read Microsurfs, the great novel of many years ago now by Douglas Copeland. And that's not precisely a Silicon Valley novel. It's, you know, kind of a Pacific Northwest tech scene novel, but I think for all intents and purposes, it's sort of the same thing. And so I think that's one great kind of pole, you know, a part of the canon, I should say. But if there's other things that belong on that list, I think Close to the Machine by Ellen Ullman is one of them. She wrote a novel actually called The Bug, and that's another. But then like there ought to be 10 more books on that list, and I don't know what they are either.
Okay.
Well, maybe yours, Vincent, will be one of the next ones. Good luck to you.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Krasny. Thank you.
Appreciate your calling. And if anybody's out there, if you read Mr. Penumbra's 24-Hour Bookstore, and if you're looking for the Dragon Song Chronicles, I don't think you're going to find them.
Nope, they are wholly invented. It's the fantasy series of my dreams.
But this gets him the job.
That's right. He mentions these books, and there's a glint of recognition in Mr. Penumbra's eye. Of course, you don't realize why until much later in the book.
I'm not going to give that away. I'm just going to go to another caller here. And Kathy, that's you. Hi.
Hi. I wanted to talk about, how sad I am that so many millions of books from like pre-1930 are going in the garbage, and they belong in art museums for everybody to see for the next generations to come. And is there an organization, address, or a building where people can just donate books that are antique books that are not being taken care of? They belong in museums. And that film Arbitrage about the bankers, the super rich, are deciding what art and film and music and everything pre-1930, what gets saved and what doesn't. 99% of world culture is going extinct, just like the dolphins.
Listen, Kathy, you may recall in San Francisco, at the public library in San Francisco, there was a big controversy a dozen years ago because they didn't have room for books with all the new technology, and they're just burning books, deciding to burn the books because they didn't have room.
It turns out there's a lot of books in the world, and really what books need more than anything else, especially old books, is not space. It's a custodian. It's a guardian, someone who cares about them. I really respect the people who, you know, just individuals, private individuals who have old books, or even new books, you know, any kind of book, and they just love them. And you can tell that, like, they are going to shepherd that book through the world. you know, as long as they can, and then and try to make a home for it after that. I think just relying on institutions that have to look after thousands of books. I mean, like they talk about them in terms of, you know, feet or yards or miles, shelving miles of books. That's
but you can
much.
Also put them all, make them all digital now. So there's
that's you true. Know, you know, I,
why not get rid of them and you have them on?
Well, and Kathy, I'd say this is not quite what you're looking for. But you know, there's a amazing institution called the Internet Archive in the city. It has its headquarters in the Presidio or near the Presidio, and they will take books and they'll scan them. They don't keep the books because they can't afford to, you know, keep books in boxes either. But they will digitize them, and they do it really well. And so at least, you know, we've got that. We've got these beautiful high-resolution images, and they'll keep those for as long as they can.
Does that give you solace, Kathy?
I still feel like crying about it. There's just really beautiful books out there. Even like in Golden Gate Park yesterday, they had free silk postcards. They're just priceless, and they're giving them away free in Golden Gate Park. Paper sale. And people should try to collect that stuff before it gets put in the trash. Well, and UC Berkeley has the same problem. Their libraries, they're emptying them out.
Well, we appreciate your thoughts, and you obviously are old school like me, so it's good to hear from you, and I thank you for the call. Let me get another caller on here from the city. Natalie, hi.
Yes, thank you. Mr. Sloan, I loved your description of San Francisco. I've been here over 60 years, and I was wondering, I don't have a computer. I'm not computer savvy. I don't have an email. Will I enjoy your book?
I think so. I guess I should say that I hope so. There's plenty in the book that is about cities and relationships and old societies and, you know, things that would have made sense 60 years ago as much as they do today. And I hope that the technology stuff is presented not as a, you know, oh yeah, if you don't understand this, then you better close the book, but rather, hey, this is cool stuff. Maybe this book could serve as a bit of a guidebook to some of this stuff in this new world. That's what I hope, anyway.
I think you'd enjoy it, Natalie. It's a well-told story, and that's, for me at any rate, the bottom line of enjoying books. But you just said, talk about cool. There's cool digital stuff. That phrase comes up in your book. Now, I'm going to put you on the spot here. Would you rather be with books or the cool digital stuff? If you had to choose.
You don't have to choose. I won't do it.
Oh, come on. You're putting it on the spot.
I absolutely deny it. I'll say, you know, there's these, you'll see op-eds and blog posts and panels at conferences, and there's always that big versus, you know, books versus technology, you know, e-books versus print books. And I think the core fallacy is that it's not a versus.
They're not mutually exclusive.
Absolutely not. They work together.
Not never the twain shall meet. They can be synthesized.
They must be synthesized.
All right. Can you talk? Actually, there's some fun things in this book. Well, for techies, and I don't know how the last caller, Natalie, will enjoy this, but like you take us into the world of Clay's roommate Matt, and. Tell us about what he builds, because that's pretty imaginative.
Yeah. So Matt is, you know, again, you talk about this synthesis. You know, Matt by day is a special effects artist at ILM, but he's not one of these special effects artists, the vast majority of them today, that works with pixels and polygons. He still makes things out of real material. He uses knives and glue and kind of carves things and uses laser cutters and, you know, hammers and saws and all that kind of stuff. And as it turns out, he doesn't just do this at work. He does it at home as well. He's one of these guys. Again, this passion, this sort of consuming drive, you know, for better or for worse, you know, the desire to create sort of grows to encompass everything, so much so that his crazy creations are taking over the apartment.
Well, he makes a metropolis.
There's barely room to lay down in the living room.
By the way, Robin Sloan is our guest. His new book is Mr. Penumbra's 24-Hour Bookstore. A few minutes left. If you'd like to join us, it's toll-free 866-733-6786 or email us forum@kqed.org. Or since he worked at Twitter, I'll say again, you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. And let's bring on Trudy from Richmond. Hi, Trudy.
Hello. Thank you for having me on.
Glad to have you.
I believe that technology is really going to push us back to being with people.
that we're going to need that human contact at a point in time that we don't have right now because technology is so new, everybody wants to use it. But it's like artwork. You can't go to your computer to look at a piece of art. You need to hang it on your wall. It needs to be touchable. You have to see it. And based on what you're talking about with the book and asking about the future, my question is to the author, what do you think of that idea, going back to being with people?
I absolutely agree. And I think, you know, one of the things that becomes interesting is when technology actually melts away or it becomes so fundamental that we don't realize it's technology anymore. Earlier, we were talking about italics. Like, what could be more boring than italics? What could be more conventional, traditional? But it was technology at one point. It was a new invention. And so I think projecting forward then, thinking ahead 10 years, 25 years, and wondering what happens.
You notice nobody's taking the bait on that.
Nobody's, though. Yeah, I know. It's hard, and it's hard to do. But if we try it, if we try to look forward and we imagine what's the world going to look like when all this stuff that's high-tech now, like GPS on your phone and your Twitter feed and being able to be connected with everyone you know on Facebook, when that all kind of melts away and becomes just normal, I think it might be a world sort of as the one you described, Trudy. I think it's a world where we're walking around the world and little opportunities are presenting themselves. You're learning that, you know, your friend Michael is around the corner or some event, some book event is happening tonight at your local bookstore. That's all happening digitally, but it doesn't have the, like, oh, let me pull out my phone and check my news feed sort of awkwardness that it has today.
Well, if we had any lay futurists out there who wanted to call in, maybe they'd be writing science fiction, but I put a plug in here for George Saunders, who I think we booked, haven't we, Dan? A writer who is delightful, and there's a whole big cover story, I mean, not a cover story, a major story about him in the New York Times Magazine this past Sunday, who writes about futuristic things in ways that are satiric and really quite entertaining. Trudy, you want it back in here?
Yeah, I just want to mention about books that I have a library of books, and as an interior designer, I have the library and my art collection. Everything else I can make do with. But my library is a lot of reference, a lot of old books like that, and I'm not about to go and discard all my books because I can get it on the web now. And 10 years from now, I may go, oh, my God, how did I recap all my books that I threw away?
Absolutely. I mean, I think one thing that I hear really smart people say, and this is people from the world of books and people from the world of technology, is that to understand a book, you got to understand it's like a gadget with an amazing feature set. You know, it's wireless. The battery never runs out. It works all the time. It's really durable. And given those features, I think in a lot of cases, there's no reason to get rid of print books. Why would you get rid of something that capable?
Let me thank. I'm sorry, Trudy. Yeah,
I agree with that. Yeah,
okay,
that would be the bottom line, I think.
Yeah, no, I'm glad to hear from you. Thank you. Although, you know, okay, you say we must synthesize and all that, but you know, the book also addresses the whole question of serious readers. I mean, readers who are very attentive readers.
That's right.
And don't you think that they are diminishing with the new technology? It may not be as major a factor as just the pace of life and the changes that have gone through life, but they have diminished.
And I will concede there that certain properties of screens, the kind of screens we use today, they definitely don't lend themselves to deep, serious reading because it's always distracting you, right? You know, if you're using your phone, if you're using your laptop, it's constantly.
Well, I mean, people don't even read newspapers anymore for the most part under the age of about 55.
And so I actually think it's less about format or the sense that, you know, man, I wish we had more people reading paper books again, or I wish we had people reading newspapers again. But I do wish that we had maybe a few more of these smart designers working on applications and interfaces that really promoted serious concentration, that weren't always trying to distract you with something else.
Yeah, well, that may be the heart of the problem, the distractions and the lack of attention span. But you call yourself a media inventor. What do you mean by that?
It's pretty simple, and it's as much aspirational as anything else, kind of like, you know, wearing the clothes for the job you want to have, not the job you have today. Basically, being a media inventor means that you're as interested in the container as you are in the content. You know, you think about words, and we've got these formats that we know and love. We've got essays, we've got short stories, we've got novels, and many of them have been long established. They're very familiar. If you're a media inventor, you ask the question, well, what else might there be? You know, what other formats, what other ways of arranging and presenting words might we have not discovered yet? And
so sort of like the needle in the haystack, instead of looking for the needle, you think about the hay?
Maybe. It's basically taking a step back, and frankly, talking about interfaces, it's the opportunity that we have with screens today. Suddenly, if you can put your words on an iPhone screen or on a tablet screen, you can do more than just, you know, make them look like a novel or make them look like a newspaper. You can make them look like anything you want. And that's a challenge, but it's also a big opportunity.
Couple quick questions. Well, actually, I want to read a website comment from Ramin, who says, actually, lack of romance in Silicon Valley is mostly due to the gender imbalance that exists in technology and science in general. There are far more males in these fields than females. There aren't that many single females around here. And another listener says, please ask your guest whether Tracy Kidder's The Soul of a New Machine belongs in the tech culture canon.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Put that one on the list. We still need nine more, though.
Well, you know, you're on your way. You got another novel under your, at least in your future?
Working on it now, yep.
Similar fantasy type, or?
Yeah, I would say that same mix of, you know, one foot in the real world and one foot in the fantastic, yep.
And you know that you put this, describe it maybe wonderful onus on your readers to suspend their disbelief in many instances.
I think that's I like it when a writer asks me to do that. I'm always game to suspend my disbelief. So that's what I try to do.
Well, the book again, Mr. Penumbra's 24-Hour Bookstore, and the author is Robin Sloan. Thank you so much for being with us.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. You can always let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website, kqed.org/forum. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Senior editor is Dan Zoll, and executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.